Welcome to the Trinity Forum Conversations podcast. We normally publish a new episode every other week, but we're including today's episode as a bonus and as the final episode in our series on spiritual practices to consider for Lent. In this episode, we'll talk with Trinity Forum Senior Fellow Makoto Fujimura about a theology of making and how the act of repair can help us understand the grace of God and our place in the church.
When we love, I think we make. That's just the way we are made. And we respond to that making. And so we make, and then when we receive that making, we make again, right? So that kind of is what Lewis Hyde is talking about, this gift economy. When the world is full of those kinds of gifts, not just for transactional reasons, but for reasons of love, then the community comes alive because the fruit of the Spirit is alive and visible in your community.
This podcast is an edited version of an online conversation from January of 2021. You can find the full video of that conversation with transcript, as well as our full catalog of event videos on our website, ttf.org. And check out the show notes on this episode for links to further resources. Here's Cherie Harder.
We're delighted to welcome back our guest whose new book, Art Plus Faith, A Theology of Making, explores the relationship between making, knowing, and loving. He claims that artistry and creativity are not only formative, but even liturgical, in that they shape our understanding of, orientation towards, and love for both the great Creator and his creation. And he concludes, "I have come to believe that unless we are making something, we cannot know the depth of God's being or God's grace." It's a fascinating and a challenging summons, and it's hard to imagine who could make it with more imagination or insight than our guest today, Makoto Fujimura. Mako is an internationally renowned visual artist, author, and arts advocate, whose lavishly textured and pigmented works are exhibited in museums and galleries all around the world. He is the founder of the International Arts Movement, also known as IAM, now called IAM Culture Care, and has served for many years as a presidential appointee to the National Council of the National Endowment for the Arts. Mako is also an author whose works include Refractions, A Journey of Faith, Art and Culture, and his just released work, Art Plus Faith, A Theology of Making, which we've invited him here today to discuss. I'll also add, as we are very proud of this, that Mako is a senior fellow of the Trinity Forum. Mako, welcome. Great to see you.
Great to be back, Cherie. Thank you for having this conversation.
Absolutely. So before we jump into our topic today, I have to ask you about the painting just beyond you. Is this one of your newer works?
Yes, it is. I painted these outside of my studio here in Princeton, and they're called Walking on Water. And the series began after 2011 disaster, the tsunami and great Tohoku earthquake in Japan, and the ongoing nuclear crisis there. And I began the series, monumental paintings, literally walking on them in some cases, and using azurite, pulverized azurite, and malachite mixed with animal skin glue, water-based. So you're literally walking on water. But it's an energy to the victims and also prayer to ask, can we walk on water? Mm-hmm. And then as this has, as time has gone by, a friend of mine, Susie Barra, who's a percussionist and composer, visionary, came back from Himalayan hills she went with her underwater microphone to record the glaciers literally breaking apart and melting. And so I heard about this, and she was going to compose music around it. So I asked her to compose music in response to what I had previously done, same size, large paintings. And then she composed music, sent it to me, and I brought these canvases outside, listening to her music, painted these. So
Beautiful. And this is this the same painting that you used on the cover
of
your book?
That's the earlier version. That one is in Taipei private collection, but I hope to showcase these in Los Angeles in the fall.
Beautiful. So let's just dive right in. For most of us, a theology of making sounds somewhat alien or at least unusual. So yes. What is a theology of making? And how do you believe that the act of creation itself enables us to better know the original and great creator?
Yeah, so as an artist, especially when I came into faith as a follower of Christ in my 20s, I started to read the Bible, and I read it through twice, actually. I was so excited to know about this as a new follower of Christ. And then as I was reading, I was realizing that much of what I had understood as an artist actually helps to understand the Bible, because the God of the Bible is the creator. And I was especially interested in writings by William Blake and others who seem to say that God is the artist, that they find, Vincent van Gogh said Christ is the greatest artist. He painted not with paint. And so, I had this vague notion that this creator might be someone that through Christ I have access to, but as a creator or and continue to create, there's a way of reading the Bible, which is called theology of making, that really understands biblical truth through the act of making. And so I was naturally doing this, right? And I was talking to my friends, or even sometimes I get asked by a church to teach a class. And every time I would talk about a passage or even give a message, I am drawn to passages particularly that opens up when you understand God is the artist, perhaps the only artist, true artist, because God can create something out of nothing. But we are also invited to be co-creators with a small c. And so that valence or that relationship is a vast invitation that, I'm reading the Bible and I'm thinking, my goodness, this can't be true, because this kind of invitation sounds so outrageous, especially to someone that is, of outside of faith or thinking like, well, I don't deserve this God, or I don't fit in, in a religious paradigm. And yet it's an invitation given by Jesus himself, when he says, consider the lilies of the field when they are, in an utter distress of their time, fighting their scarcity battles, their, zero-sum game. And yet Jesus seems to point to the sky and look at the birds of the air. And so as an artist, I'm responding to that and saying, oh my goodness, this person of Jesus is also a remarkable artist in the way that he, just like Van Gogh said. Mm-hmm. And so I would talk about these things at times, and people look at me, funny, because I'm reading these passages in Exodus 31, 32, where Bezalel and Oholiab is creating the tabernacle, and specific dimension is given with materials, everything. It is laid out. For an artist, this is like a glorious picture of understanding God. And yeah, I talked to my friends about it, and they're like, oh, I skipped that part, cubits. I don't know what a cubit is. And I'm like, do you realize what you're missing? Because a cubit is, this, and they used to measure Pharaoh's arm, and now they're measuring Moses' arm to create a tabernacle, and so I go on and on, and I learned to kind of not say those things in church, because people misunderstand, he's just a crazy artist. But then I realized, Jerry, that at some point I realized that this is fundamentally part of the narrative of Scripture. In fact, those dimensions were given at the same time that the Decalogue was given, right? So Moses came down to Mount Sinai with this dimension, and he appointed Bezalel and Oholiab, who literally used a melted down golden calf to build the tabernacle. So this is part of God's way of communicating to us and God's invitation for us to create something to communicate back to God. But we miss that because we're, you know, talking about this perhaps this transactional reality or a truncated view of the gospel. And when I read N.T. Wright's writings on, primarily on his writings on Discourse on the Resurrection, I was just blown away. You know, I was privileged to meet him and this really study under him. Mm-hmm. But when he talks about the new creation, he's talking about this kind of artistry and mastery that God invokes in us. And so that means our artists are really important for the new creation, that like we are supposed to be one of the leaders, just like Bezer and Hollier were in their time. We are supposed to be the kind of people who see beyond and can bring in the new creation to our world, and our churches and our worship depends on that. So when I see the, as we talked about before in cultural care dialogue, when the plights of artists are today exiled into the margins, when they feel like they don't fit into the, you know, either the church culture or, you know, they are suspect, you know, because they talk about these, you know, ways of understanding even scripture differently, perhaps. So I started to write about this. I started to, and that, you know, it's basically my life work is what you have in your hand. It's actually one third of what I had written that my editor did a fine job of compressing so that we have, digestible pieces, because I just keep observing in the Bible that this is an amazing manual, amazing entry into new creation.
You know, it's interesting. You speak a little bit about just sort of the truncated view that we have outside of artistry. And one of the things you mentioned in your book is that, I think you put it this way, that we as a culture are in need of epistemological therapy, which is sort of a big word, but I guess basically to examine the roots of what we assume to be knowledge. And so I wanted to ask you about essentially that gap or that difference between informational knowing, which is sort of what, you know, we as efficient Western people often sort of focus on, and relational knowing, or even somatic knowing, kind of the knowing, you know, with your hands.
Yes.
What is it that we can know through making that would be inaccessible to us through proposition or argument?
Yeah. So that's, I'm quoting my good friend, philosopher Esther Meek there. Her writings on epistemology has really been very significant part of my journey toward what I call somatic knowledge, or, you know, theology of making. That so the easiest way is one of the examples that I use in the book, you know, is when I moved to Princeton, I had chickens and they had eggs, you know, and so I'm like, wow, this is fresh eggs, you know. You know, it's hard to get in New York City. Now I have them every day. So how do you make an omelet, right? So I look on YouTube and I see Jack Papin making omelets, you know, and as you know, omelet is the simplest recipe, right? It's just the egg. But
and yet I mess it up all the time.
Exactly, right. Like I copy everything Jack Papin's doing, and my omelet does not come anything close to So the informational recipe, right, does not translate necessarily to the actual making. And furthermore, the real test isn't tasting. You know, even if it looks good when you taste it, if it's not good, then you failed, right? Now, let's look at the information age and what we have done to any kind of truth, but also, you know, the biblical truth, right? We have taken the recipe and we argue over the recipe. You know, we create denominations or various ways that we interpret, you know, salt. And then, you know, we never ask, what's the fruit? You know, what are you creating because of your faith in that recipe? And that seems rather strange. We all understand that the test of recipe for omelet is the omelet. And it's not just the omelet, it's how the omelet tastes, right? Is it good? If it's good, you can kind of trace back to, oh, this is how you made it. I want to learn that because this tastes good. But we don't do that with knowledge. So what Esther Meek is saying, we have this epistemological default where we create binaries all the time when we say, you know, left versus right, you know, African-Americans against white communities. I mean, all these things are false binaries that we create to satisfy our lust for certainty, which is also, I'm quoting a friend of mine, Bruce Herrmann, but it's really a tendency that in post-industrial times, we have come to this positioning that because of fear, we are concerned about ever-shrinking territories of anything, including culture, but you know that leads to culture wars, because we think unless we do this, you know, we're going to lose everything. But the problem is not so much the concerns we have about culture, but this default position that we created, forcing everybody to have to take a position, demonize the other side to justify their positions. And this happens in academia. This happens in, you know, street corners, conversation between neighbors. This is happening in culture at large. So Esther points to that. I borrow her to talk about, okay, so what is somatic knowledge? You know, how do we get to theology of making rather than, you know, theology that perhaps we argue over? There's nothing wrong with, you know, with discerning and, you know, even arguing over something. But the test is in the fruit of making. So, you know, how are we doing is first question, you know, like, how am I doing? How are we doing collectively? How is our culture doing? But also, you know, if you care about the church, we should be asking, how is our church doing in producing good fruit into the culture at large, not just ourselves, but culture at large? When they taste our omelet, is it good?
Oh, there's so much to unpack there. Let me ask you about, of course, you know, sort of the ultimate fruit. I mean, the Bible says that they will know we are Christians by our love. So exactly. Let me ask you about the role of love in all of this. You know, in your book, you describe, and I thought this was beautiful, the creation of the world as God singing the world into being, with the song being a love poem. And it actually made me think about Martin Luther King Jr.'s statement that love is the most irresistibly creative power in the universe. And so I wanted to ask you about both love and the act of creating. If love evokes creativity, does the act of making also help us to love? Or if not, how should we understand the connection between them?
Yeah, so as an artist, you know, artist is struggling with ego part and self-expression, controlling that kind of ego identity versus what poet Lewis Hyde, HYDE, calls in his book, The Gift, art is fundamentally a gift. You receive it, you give it away. But, you know, there's nothing wrong with putting it in a transactional market. But when we lose that sense, which what he's saying is art is based in love. You know, and creation is based on love. When you start with Genesis and when you see a God creating, right? We kind of read those passages and say, "Oh, God created in 7 days." Right? I mean, and we argue over that, right? But fundamentally, what God is doing is, you know, creating something that God doesn't need at all, which we don't fully understand because we tend to create things out of our need, right? But God doesn't need us. God doesn't need creation. God doesn't need the universe. So why did God create? Well, God created because he is purely love. And love exudes. Love is gratuitous. God, you know, so I give this example. I'm invited to speak at a boys' high school, you know, once in a while. And I, you know, these high school students are sitting around like rolling their eyes because, you know, artist is coming. So, you know, what's the big deal, right? So I say, well, guys, you know, you need the arts because if you're going on a date, you know, you don't do accounting. You don't do engineering. No, you take the ladies out to, you know, partners out to museums, listen to concerts. And if you don't understand music and art and beauty, you're going to be at a loss. Because love, by definition, is something that goes way outside of utilitarian values and efficiencies and industrial bottom lines. It has to. So we all know that. So why are we so caught up in this sense of wanting to please God and follow Christ, only be so concerned about our bottom lines of survival when God has released us from all this already? And when we love, I think we make. That's just the way we are made. And we respond to that making. So we make, and then when we receive that making, we make again, right? So that kind of is what Lewis Hyde is talking about, this gift economy. When the world is full of those kinds of gifts, not just for transactional reasons, but for reasons of love, then the community comes alive, because the fruit of the Spirit is alive and visible in your community. And so that's the real test, is do we have love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, gentleness, goodness, faithfulness, and self-control? Do we have the fruit of the Spirit embedded in everything we do? And when I pull back, and I ask this for culture care, but you know, when we look at our communities and look at our communities, our, you know, culture at large, when we ask that question, unfortunately, no, we have the opposite. We have, you know, divisiveness, hatred instead of love. You know, instead of peace, we have anxiety. You know, instead of joy, we seem to be rather depressed about, you know, nature of the Christian church. Yeah. So there are exceptions, and I'm happy to list those exceptions, but by large, we have failed in our individualized discipleship. Mm-hmm. We talk about it for individuals, but we don't ask the larger community and culture question.
Right. In your work, at various points, you refer to essentially the embodiment of the fruits as a sanctified imagination.
Yes.
And you say at one point, in a world of sanctified imagination, we'll come to see dominion over the earth as based not on power and domination, but on loving stewardship. Yeah. And then you say that something I thought was very interesting. We are not able to fully love until we begin to lovingly name the world around us. Yeah. And so I wanted to ask you what that means and what that looks like. I mean, obviously, naming is an inherently imaginative act and a creative act. But what does it mean to name the world around us? And how would we cultivate that kind of sanctified imagination?
Yeah, so I talk about Genesis 2, Adam naming the animals, which is the first act of creativity in the Bible by Adam and by any of us because of that. And so naming the animals is, you know, is a poetic act, really. It is to name something where we're allowing this capacity, our capacity to imagine and make. And, you know, when we are naming, and that's why we need poets, mm-hmm. to not just name things as categories, but name them extravagantly, name them beautifully, name our situation, the fractures that we're in, with extravagance. And that's what Amanda Gorman did in the inauguration. Her poem is this exquisite naming of our time. And that's why we respond to it. That's why we think, you know, once again, poetry is back. You know, you know, T.S. Eliot used to fill Wembley Stadium. Now Amanda Gorman can. You know, that's a spectacular thing that happened in this time of pain and fracture. So naming allows human capacity to name is the beginning of all making. So in naming, we're paying attention. We're being honest, we're being somewhat vulnerable, because whatever we make or name may or may not be good, right? So we're taking that risk. Now, fortunately, in Eden, when Adam named an animal, that was it, right? God gave authority, and the word authority has the word author in it, right? So in case where these, you know, many artists struggle with that word. So the word authority is naming, given the power and the permission to name. And God doesn't say, giraffe, are you sure you want to make it giraffe? You know, no, God says, yes, that's a great name. I think I read in a subway poster once that Bronx Zoo has 4,000 species of animals. So that's a 4,000 yes, affirmative yes, that God gave Adam. And, you know, that kind of climate, right, is very different from what we have. You know, I tested myself when I had small kids, like how many times do I say no, you know, rather than yes. and it turned out to be like 80%, but yeah. So naming is a very important aspect of also affirming, right? Receiving affirmation, or even by naming, we are affirming that existence in a way that leads into, in my mind, new creation.
So not only is naming part of making, but mending is also part of making.
Yeah.
And in this book, as well as several of your other recent works, you discuss the ancient Japanese tradition of kintsugi, both as an illustration as well as a metaphor of the potential of the artist to not simply repair what is broken, but to, in a sense, reimagine and recreate something that has been damaged into something even more complex and beautiful. And I was hoping you could explain a little bit about what kintsugi is and what it means to you, and why you believe that, in your own words, we need to have a kintsugi culture.
Yeah, so I have a piece here, Sherry. This is a kintsugi bowl that was mended by my friend Esther Moon in our first kintsugi academy. We created this kit working with a kintsugi master in Tokyo that we have now made it available on Shopify, so we could give you links for that. But this bowl was fractured, and you can see the fracture here that we use Japan lacquer. But instead of in a Western way, if we were fixing something, we make it so it doesn't look like it was broken. In Japan, out of tea ceremony tradition refined in 16th century, there was this idea, you might have heard of wabi-sabi, you know, which is Japanese concept for beauty. But that was really, that came out in 16th century Japan out of tea, high tea tradition. And so when an important tea bowl breaks, families of tea masters will often hold on to the fragments for several generations. And then they will give it to a kintsugi master, a Japan lacquer master, to mend it, not hiding the flaws, but accentuating the flaws, and then putting gold on it, and thereby making the fractured bowl more valuable than before it broke. So it's a beautiful metaphor for new creation. And when you think about it, what Esther did here is also great, because, by the way, this was the first time she did kintsugi, so it's pretty amazing. But not only she mended the fracture and made it new, but she added a design to make it even more accentuated, right? So this is a profound way that imagination and artistry can look at a fracture, anything that is fractured, which we know, as we know, especially in DC, there's a lot of fracture. But instead of saying, we're going to fix this, right? We look at the fragments, we name the fragments, you know, and then we say, what is something new that can come out of these fractures? Rather than running away from those fractures, let's name, walk into it, hold on to it, and create something that uniquely comes out of those fragments. And again, Amanda Goldman's example comes to mind, because what she did was, after the Capitol was, you know, the riot, she changed her poem, right, in response to that. But she created something new, taking that opportunity, bringing something beautiful to heal us with her words in a time when words were so debased. And that kind of elevation is something that an artist can do. And that's what a Kintsugi master has always done. And so part of our journey moving forward, as we, you know, struggle with fractures and shutdowns and the ongoing difficulties that we will face, what are some of the ways that we can look at those things, very painful things, but see something new in them? And that takes a different mindset. It takes patience. It takes love. It takes love to say, even though this is broken, I'm going to treasure this. Instead of trying to fix it, I'm going to mend so that I can make something new out of it. And if we can do that, then it's going to change how we look at the world, how we look at ourselves. Imagine a church. When somebody new walks in and they tell their stories of fracture, instead of saying, oh, we have a program to help you, instead of saying, you know, oh, I'm so sorry, you know, but, you know, we welcome you because, you know, you can be like us. What if the whole community held the fractures together as a Kintsugi master would? And maybe some traumas require several generations. Mm-hmm. You know, that might be true. But what if we had a place, you know, where a broken hallelujahs can be embraced, invited? It's something that we ourselves say, praise God you're here, because your fragment is so unique and we need you. You know, and we want to be mending here, healing together, because all of us are broken. And, you know, and we're so glad you're here. We're so glad your piece is, you know, finally held to the light. And we're going to journey together.
Thanks, Marco. Yeah. I wanted to ask you just one thing about your last answer, in that one theme I've just sort of perceived in talking with you is one of the first steps to mending or making is seeing. And as we talked about last time, one of the things that you talked about Kintsugi Masters doing is actually beholding, looking at the fractured bowl for quite a long time before starting a recreating process. And in your book, you actually talk about your own practice of simply sitting in front of a work of art for an extended period of time. And I think you said it takes you at least 15 minutes or so before you can see, and that we're actually sort of trained to categorize and move on. Yeah. And I have a feeling that probably many of our viewers would be really intrigued by that concept, but also like, where does one even start? So I guess the question is, what are the steps, what are the practices, or how does one learn to see deeply?
Yeah, or hear deeply. Or okay. I think we are created to be able to take in experiences and really be able to experience transcendence through all things. There are burning bushes everywhere, right? Calvin Silva said, we just stopped taking our shoes off. If we just learn to slow down and look and to hear, there's so much mystery in the world that we are missing constantly because we're so busy going from A to Z. And again, those things are not by themselves wrong. It's just that I think we're learning in this time of shutdown that when you slow down, you notice some things deeply. And that might be painful. You know, maybe that's why we're so busy, because we're trying to run away from our traumas and our brokenness. When we really don't have to, and part of what I said about the church is, church should be a place, right, where you do come together to slow down, to experience God's transcendence. And, you know, many places like museums and concert halls, they can help us as well. When I tell people that, you know, that David Brooks came into my exhibit in New York, and I said, you know, David, it's gonna take you like 15 minutes to see my work. And he was like, what? You know, and he actually sat there for 15 minutes. And he said it was astonishing what he saw. Like, he couldn't believe it. He thought it was a monochromatic blue-green painting. And he said, I saw a whole galaxy open up before me. And that experience alone will bring us to healing, because we are so used to, you know, being overly categorized and creating this epistemological defaults of just categorizing, identifying that person, and then, you know, and then moving on. You know, but if we slow down and actually observe, even people that we don't agree with, you know, even situations that we're uncomfortable in, when we allow ourselves to be an artist and say, you know, I'm here to observe, I'm here to take in, I'm going to take my time, I'm going to listen, and I'm going to look. And after a while, you begin to see an entirely different world. And so I think for somebody who, what I just said seems so alien, that's what happens when we fall in love. Things slow down. That's what happens when we see a beautiful sunset, fireworks in July skies. Our brain is opening up. And by the end of, you know, an hour of watching this abstraction in the sky, we feel somewhat more whole. We feel connected to the person next to us. And so everybody's had this experience. We just don't think that, you know, because art, you know, is so strange, you know, we can't tap into it. You know, every time you have a meal with your family or your loved ones, I mean, this is something, you know, like it's different between eating the same meal alone and same meal with your friends, right? What's the difference? Well, there's conversation, there's acknowledgement, there's naming, there's exchange of, you know, blessings. That's what makes the meal taste better. So it's not just, we're not just, you know, machines that are digesting. We are made for love. We are made for community. We are made for these conversations that points to the abundance of God. And when we are kind of on a journey toward that, we all become artists. We become artists, certainly of the kingdom, but artists who are makers. We're all makers. So that's how I think Kintsugi generation can be birthed. By the way, the younger generation already knows this, and they're already practicing it. Our generation needs to just learn from them because they understand that culture wars are ultimately futile in the very values that you're trying to protect. You end up decimating your own ground every time you fight that battle. So younger generation is already done with that. They're like, no, we care about the world. We care about the environment. We care about community. We care about creativity and imagination. And so, you know, I'm really hopeful because of people like Amanda, you know, people who speak into the divide with that exuberant and fantastic rhythm, you know, as God sings over us. Our young people are singing back at us. And that's a sign of hope that I think we can all, you know, learn from.
That's beautiful. Thanks, Marco. Finally, as promised, the last word is yours.
Thank you, Sherry. It's been really great to be with you again. And I love these questions, so I'll try to address them in the future. But I wrote this benediction at the end of my book, which I will read. It's a benediction to makers, which I said is all of you. Let us remember that we are sons and daughters of God, the only true artist of the kingdom of abundance. We are God's heirs, princesses, and princes of this infinite land beyond the sea, where heaven will kiss the earth. May we steward well what the Creator King has given us, and accept God's invitation to sanctify imagination and creativity, even as we labor hard on this side of eternity. May our art, what we make, be multiplied into the new creation. May our poems, music, and dance be acceptable offerings for the cosmic wedding to come. May our sandcastles, created in faith, be turned into permanent grand mansions in which we will celebrate the great banquet of the table. Let us come and eat and drink at the supper of the Lamb now, so that we might be empowered by this meal to go into the world to create and to make, and return to share what we have learned on this journey toward the new.
Marco, thank you so much. It's always a delight.
Yes, great to be here.
Thank you for listening to this episode. Be sure to subscribe to Trinity Forum Conversations podcast to make sure you don't miss any future episodes. And if you're enjoying these, please leave us a review. Visit our website at ttf.org for more information and show notes from this episode, as well as resources such as our Trinity Forum readings and videos from our past events.